Technology, it's such a big part of our lives. It can be fun, it can be convenient, just like this podcast, which is why University of Missouri Healthcare is proud to support podcasting on KBIA. Technology can also save your life. That's why so many people turn to University of Missouri Healthcare. Its hospitals and clinics offer you the latest technology, plus a medical team whose skill and knowledge are unparalleled. You know technology makes everyday life a lot better. Well, it's true for your healthcare, too. University of Missouri Healthcare, the care you deserve from the team you trust.
Hello, and welcome to Under the Microscope, KBIA's weekly look into stories in science, health, and technology. I'm Raymond Tungekar. On this week's show, we'll hear from the director of an acclaimed documentary that explores the difficult choices involved with physician-assisted suicide. But first, getting a definitive answer on food industry claims, like natural or fresh, might mean poring over pages of advice from government agencies or checking out consumer advocate websites. But as Harvest Public Media's Jessica Najunas reports, what goes into food sometimes can be difficult to interpret.
Pick up a box of your favorite packaged food. Now read the ingredient list. Think about how many of those recipe elements you can identify as good for you. Those puzzling words may be what are called food additives. Some have a helpful purpose. Acids help food stay fresher longer. And because they're in so much of our food today, they are tough to avoid.
The ingredients are water, organic whole wheat flour, organic unbleached wheat flour, and sea salt.
That's Jill Lucht reading the back of a local company's sourdough wheat bread package. She knows a lot about food. At the University of Missouri's Agriculture Department, she helps beginning farmers get on their feet. And in her spare time, she volunteers at a local goat farm.
I feel pretty good about eating this.
Most of the food in her big black refrigerator contains snacks near to their original form. But there are a few things, Lucht says, that she hasn't considered until this moment, like her whole grain tortillas.
Vegetable shortening, which is palm oil with monoglycerides. That's kind of disturbing.
This palm oil keeps the product shelf stable for longer than, say, vegetable oil. It's generally recognized as safe by the Food and Drug Administration, but that doesn't mean it's good for you. In 2009, the U.S. Department of Agriculture researched palm oil and found it was not a healthy substitute for much maligned trans fats.
The multigrain blend has three lines of text, but it's all, you know, actual real food. So we get to the end where we get to the sodium, aluminum, phosphate, fumaric acid, mono and diglycerides, that part, the dough conditioner. So I might give these up. It's scary because I don't know what they are.
A University of Michigan study found that scary food names means a perceived high risk. They asked people to rate safety for fake additives with names that were both easy and confusing. On average, it was the tricky food additive name that had people fearing for their health. Though recently, some very simple-sounding additives have caused real trouble.
One of the categories of food additives that's long been of concern is food dyes, red 40, yellow 5, that you'll find on thousands of packaged foods in grocery stores.
Michael Jacobson is the executive director of Consumer Health Advocacy Group Center for Science in the Public Interest. You might know him from the phrases he's helped coin over the years, like the pervasive junk food.
There have been questions about the dye's safety. There's been the most publicity attention to the notion that food dyes may affect children's behavior.
That attention swelled with a food industry cliffhanger last March when Jacobson's team petitioned the FDA to consider a rule that would ban synthetic food dyes.
The Food and Drug Administration, for the first time, acknowledged that food dyes affect the behavior of a subgroup of kids, kids who have hyperactivity. Food dyes can trigger that behavior.
So the FDA gathered experts to evaluate if food dyes would do the same thing to all kids. They found there wasn't enough evidence to support this idea, and that's where the issue has stayed frozen in time. In other countries, there's the opposite. The UK and Europe banned synthetic food dyes over 3 years ago, using some of the same evidence the Center for Science and the Public Interest brought to the FDA.
In the United States, we want to provide consumers with the information they need to make decisions about their lives.
Doug Karras is with the FDA.
If you want to avoid color additives, they are listed in the ingredients on the label. It's just a matter of seeing if there's color additives, and then you would know that you want to avoid that.
Putting responsibility into the consumer's hands, that is, if you have the know-how and the time to translate, there are tools around today that can help. If you're looking for an independent source, the Center for Science and the Public Interest has Chemical Cuisine, a smartphone app with safety ratings. If it's official word from the government you're after, then settle in for the long haul. The FDA still has to collect more research on dyes like red 40 and yellow 5 before the agency can give a possible green light to food dye warnings. Jessica Najunas, Harvest Public Media.
The film How to Die in Oregon follows several people as they undertake the difficult decision to end their lives under the state's controversial Death with Dignity Act. This week, the film comes out on DVD. But I spoke to the film's director, Peter Richardson, when he visited Columbia earlier this year. He began by telling me about the Death with Dignity Act.
Oregon was the first state in the country and only the third place in the world to formally legalize physician aid in dying, which is called the Death with Dignity Act in Oregon. And basically, the law stipulates that if two doctors determine that a person has less than 6 months to live, that person can legally request a fatal dose of barbiturates to end their life. And it was officially enacted in 1997. And since it's been enacted, I think it's probably close to about 600 people have actually used the law to end their life.
And you grew up in Oregon, correct?
I did, yeah.
Like in your consciousness growing up?
Well, I moved to Oregon when I was 5 years old, and so certainly I was around when this law was passed. But, you know, truthfully, when you're a young person, you don't give a law like this very much thought. So I was aware of it, but it wasn't something that I had any direct or personal experience with.
Before you even started filming, though, it's a very sensitive topic. Mm-hmm. What issues did you anticipate happening? Did you have to prepare yourself for as a documentarian?
Well, the biggest thing that I had to prepare myself for, of course, was just forming these very personal relationships with people who would ultimately die, who would not be there by the end of filming. So that was a really difficult decision to kind of undertake that journey, like go on that journey. And there were a lot of people who I talked to kind of as I was considering making this film who I think warned me about it and tried to dissuade me from making the film just because they felt that the personal burden or cost would be too great, that it would be too difficult to go and make this film. But I had such conviction about wanting to tell this story that I just kind of moved past that. And ultimately, it was indeed a very difficult journey, and it was very difficult forming these relationships and then losing people. But at the same time, it was, incredible gift to have been able to film with them and experience a part of their lives. And I think that's one of the gifts of being a documentary filmmaker is that you're given access into people's lives, people who you would never otherwise meet in the course of your daily life. And, I learned a tremendous amount from all the people that I filmed with, and this film and other films, but I think especially this film, because when you are confronted with the end of your life, you really start to think about, well, what's most important? How am I going to live each day? Do I want to be here tomorrow? I think the wisdom that someone has who has been given a terminal diagnosis is really extraordinary, and I think some of that kind of comes through in the film.
That's it for Under the Microscope this week. Thanks for listening. To hear an extended version of my conversation with Peter Richardson, just head to our website, kbia.org.